should be kissed and often. And by someone who knows how.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
I love that voice. Hi, everybody. This is Wes with CIA. Our topic today is book-to-film adaptations. What makes them work? What makes them not work? Some good ones and some bad ones. Our favorites and our not-so-favorites. Joining me on the show today is my friend Audrey, who was here last week. Hello, Audrey.
Hello, Wes.
And we're hoping the sound quality is a lot better because we're doing something different today. Because we're different. Anyway, I guess, do you want to do this? Let's talk about older films and progress to the newer stuff. Because you got to think, back in the early days of film, pretty much everything is adapted from a book. You know, one of... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're correct. That would have... I mean, what else would they have based it on?
Right. I mean, like, one of the earliest films that they made was The Wizard of Oz. And if you've ever seen Nosferatu, actually. Yes. If you ever saw the silent Wizard of Oz, it's a lot more close to the tone of the book.
Oh, yes.
And the way they drew the characters was also... Well, drew the characters. The way they did the makeup was closer to the artistic... Right. I guess what I would say is pictures that were in the book. And I don't know if you've ever seen it. It's very hard to watch. Silent films kind of are in this day of talkies.
Yeah, but the black and white. I've seen bits of it.
It's kind of hard. And then, you know, and they did the actual one that everyone holds beloved in their hearts. It brings up a point. There's a lot of it that's not really has anything to do with the book, I think. I've read the book, and they changed a lot of it for the musical, but I can see why they did. If you watch the making of special, they explain why they do all that stuff.
Well, you have to edit out. I mean, the book itself is an allegory, a political allegory, and dealing with coming off the gold standard. And so, you know, they had to take it out because they were aiming for a general audience and a children's audience, whereas the original book was much more than that, just like Alice in Wonderland.
Right, you know, Alice in Wonderland's about drugs.
No, it's not. I mean, Lewis Carroll began the children's genre, really, but when you look at those two movies, both of them have to be edited. The new, we're already jumping to the new ones, but speaking of Alice in Wonderland, the new Alice in Wonderland coming out with Johnny Depp is going to be much more true to the book, much darker. And so that's with Wizard of Oz. There's a whole lot of things that they've taken out from the original books and even the series of books in order to make it more appealing and to simplify a plot. You just can't have all that.
Right. Well, I mean, you can only cram so much into a 2-hour span. And
or in Wizard of Oz's case, like almost 3 hours.
Is that how long it's going to be?
Wizard of Oz? It
the,
is.
The new one or the old one?
No, you're thinking Alice in Wonderland. Wizard of Oz.
I am. That's right. It is almost 3 hours. It's a, you know, it's a, I just watched it recently because the people that are my roommates bought a Blu-ray player and got Wizard of Oz on Blu-ray, and then they proceeded to be like, this is the cheesiest thing I've ever seen. I'm like, it's a kid's movie. It's supposed to be. And it was from 1939. They'd seen it, but they hadn't seen it in years. So they're expecting it to be, and I don't have to say, just on a side note, Wizard of Oz on Blu-ray is amazing. It just, the picture quality will hurt your eyes. It's so clear.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, see, the thing with Wizard of Oz, like you'll notice Dorothy is wearing red shoes. In the book, they're not red. I have a lot of students that try to say they're reading Wizard of Oz just because they like to pretend to read books they're not reading. And I always say, really, what do you think about her shoes? Oh, I want ruby slippers. They're not ruby in the book.
No, they're silver in the book.
Shh, don't tell my students
that.
Oh,
sorry. Yeah, they're all going to be listening to you now, aren't they?
Yes, really. But, you know, they were experimenting with color. So when Dorothy's in Kansas, she's in black and white. And when she moves to the land of Oz, it's all colored. That's why they wanted her shoes to be ruby slippers instead of silver.
Yeah, it really contrasts to the surrounding area. Like the Munchkin Land's very bright. And, you know, what's funny is the guys that made the movies put a lot of their own kind of little allegories into it with the colors and what they mean, as well as what the story was about. And, you know, the Yellow Brick Road is the gold standard.
It's the gold standard. And her shoes are the silver, you know.
Yeah.
So it all goes.
Baum was kind of a genius because if you get, actually, they did a movie in the 80s starring Fairuz Abbott called Return to Oz, which is actually close to the book.
To it. Right.
And if you watch it, they kind of made it a pseudo-sequel because some of the elements in the original Wizard of Oz are in there, and like the design of the Scarecrow and the Tin Man and all that. But they stuck with the old classic 1930s look or the 1800s look of the characters, and I liked it a lot better, actually. It was darker, but his books get very dark.
Yes.
And, his books are very similar to me in tone to the Narnia books, the way that C.S. Lewis wrote. It's very similar. Once you get into
Same time period, similarly.
It's the later books of Baum that are like the mid books in the Narnia trilogy. There's some similarities in the stories. But, you know, L. Frank Baum wrote like 30-something Oz books.
Right.
And I haven't even begun to read half of them. I've gotten about the first 5 books, you know. And
yeah, I think that's all I've done, too, and I just lost interest.
He's kind of long-winded, and I'm sorry I stepped on you again. We were just talking about how, hey, we could see each other. We're not going to step on each other. And I'm like,
it's just this delay with the camera thing. It's like, yeah. Your mouth isn't moving. You must be finished.
And for those of y'all listening, you will never get to see this video, ever. Only when we're on stage at a convention or something will you see us talking.
Right.
But I digress. I've noticed that in our current trend of remakes, you know, we're remaking classic films. Before I get moving, I need to point out that the year The Wizard of Oz came out, 1939, is considered the greatest year in movie history. All the major classics that you think about came out that year. Like, Oz came out, and Nanochka came out. I don't know if you know about that, but it's a pretty good movie. You had, what was the other big one? Wuthering Heights came out.
That's one of my all-time favorite books, very good adaptation of a book.
The original one, the 1939
yes.
version?
Yes.
The BBC has done some telemovies based on Jane Austen and her contemporaries.
That's
Bronte. Yeah, I know. I was going to get to that. Okay, see? Jumping right ahead there. I should let the English teacher go. She knows more about it than me anyway. Teaches it all the time. But the BBC does a really good job of adapting those books because, hey, it's their author, you know.
Right.
And on a side note,
literature.
If you're a fan of stuff like Pride and Prejudice, they now have authors are putting – they got one out by Jane Austen and this guy. It says Jane Austen and so-and-so, and it's called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. And what they've done is taken Pride and Prejudice and added a zombie holocaust at the same time. So it's written in the style of Jane Austen, and half the book is hers, but it's funny. To hear, you know, people like Heathcliff hacking zombies to death because they're trying to protect their... It's just funny. It's one of those odd little genres that's out there. They're working on one with Mary Shelley's Frankenstein where they turn it around somewhere or another. But anyway,
that's another interesting book that was made into a movie in the horror genre, whereas, I mean, the book, she was proving that women could write horror, but... It's so much more than that, but they leave it in the movie as just strictly horror rather than man's monster's search for humanity.
Right, and that is a total allegory, that book. And the Universal horror, the Universal movie is a classic, and it's well done, and it's somewhat scary for that time period, but it really doesn't have much to do with its source. It's more shock value than anything else.
And I think a lot of books, as we have this discussion, are going to come across how they're losing their source and they're so loosely based on the book, it's hard to find the plot in them in order to make an entertaining movie because you just can't have the same character development. There has to be action, there has to be speech, whereas in a book you can do their thinking and you can do the description and rising action and exposition that way that you can't do in a movie. You can't drag it that slowly.
You know, there's only been one movie that I can remember, really, that the whole movie you could hear what they were thinking, and it was David Lynch's adaptation of Frank Herbert's Dune. It's a sci-fi film, Dune, and it's a long, long, drawn-out, but yeah. But you can hear what they're thinking. I always thought that was neat,
right.
But that really took you out of the movie because then it's, you know, they're all, of course... The way they record people thinking is they sound like this, like they're whispering in their head, and then they're not really whispering in their head. They're, you know,
right.
I think in
some movies do it well. You've mentioned Ferris Bueller before, where he breaks that fourth wall, as you phrase it, And it can be done well. The Wonder Years is done well, where they just turn to the camera and say, this is where I keep expecting my mom to ground me. You
know? Yeah. That I love when movies, one of my that's my favorite style of movie, is when the character will like look out at the camera and talk to us about what's going on. My favorite movie of all time right now, I have the just periods where they change, but is High Fidelity, which the whole movie, the guy's explaining his relationships with these different girls, and the stuff he says to the camera just cracks you up. And it, right. and it also kind of gets to you a little bit, but the, you know, I don't remember movies before like the 1960s that did that, though. It was like a style that came up in the, you know, 70s and upwards of breaking the fourth wall, because back then, movies were just plays that were recorded, you know, onto film. And you can tell by the acting, a lot of those people were stage performers because they didn't get to that natural progression of dialogue. It was all, you know, just very, I am up on the stage and I am saying my lines.
Right.
And
it was stodgy.
Right. With book adaptations, it's even worse because the thing that the screenwriters at the time would do is take actual dialogue out of the books and throw it on the screen. And that doesn't work sometimes because the way you do rhyme and meter writing a story is a lot different than talking it. If you wrote down what we were saying right now, it wouldn't look that great on the page. You have to flower it up a little bit sometimes or structure it differently. We sound like goobers sometimes when we talk.
Well, you do.
Okay. Well, you're right there. I've had many comments about the way I speak.
I just sound like a hick.
So. You took that opening and you ran with it. I'm proud of you. She's not afraid to make fun of me on my own show, where I have the mute button in my hand. Of course, if I muted her out, I'd just be you listening to by myself, which is, as we know from past shows, very boring.
I think an interesting change you've seen in movies coming up through the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s is how they change camera things and ideas. Before about 1970, they would show people walking into the building and walking in through the door, and then you'd see them open the door and come through. Whereas as film progressed into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, if you saw somebody walking into the building and the next thing you knew they were inside the office, the audience could understand, okay, they went in the building, got in the elevator, went to the top floor, and came through a door.
Oh, yeah.
Prior to about 1970, they show all the actions, which I guess...
What they were doing was basically putting a film version of the book, but they were also including all the stuff that they were doing. So they had to open the mail slot, lick the stamp, stick the letter in the mail slot, close the door. I mean, there's some people that could just say, I'm writing a letter, and then you show them, toss the letter, and that's it. We're smart enough to understand that they went through the door, like you're saying.
Right.
Another movie from 1939, which was the biggest movie in history, is Gone with the Wind. And that's one that got changed a lot. But we were talking earlier, she and I, about the fact that the changes they made for the movie actually worked for the movie.
Right.
You know, a lot of movies, they change too much, and it's just a movie in name only, or an adaptation in name only. But Gone with the Wind had enough elements to be the book, but took out a lot of stuff that really wouldn't have helped that movie at all.
Right. Like her children, Scarlett has a child by each of her husbands,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't, they don't do anything for the plot. There's very little, in fact. The only thing useful I could say her child by her first husband did, I'm trying to think of his name, Wade Hampton did, was when she has Bonnie with Rhett, he makes the comment that he doesn't get invited to parties. Why doesn't he get invited to parties? And that causes Rhett to say, we've got to change how we're living. We've got to be better Southerners, really, is what it comes down to, so that Bonnie can go to all the best parties instead of all the Yankee parties. And that's really the only thing he did for the plot, and her daughter, Ella, doesn't do anything for the plot.
Well, just in the book, you're fleshing out characters and adding situations for them, but like in the movie, I think there's more impact with Bonnie's character because they're, you know, they waited later in life to have children, and Rhett, you know, just adored her, and then when what happens to her happens, it really shows the big problem.
When you say later in life, Scarlett's only like 24.
Yeah, I know, but...
Yeah.
When you watch,
she's maybe not even that old because.
Right.
You know,
it's a 4-hour movie. It seems like decades go by when you're watching. And then you watch Scarlett, and they got, you know, Val Kilmer's ex-wife playing Scarlett. She looks a lot older than Vivian Leigh did at the time. And you think, well, Scarlett's probably gone through about 25 years worth of stuff. And then you realize that by the end of that really questionable book miniseries. You know, that's a movie from a sequel to a book. I mean, that's not written by the same author, which is a whole nother genre, you know.
Right.
And it just doesn't work. And then
so
Gone
with the Wind,
you already used the iconic character.
I think another thing you find with movies with their editing, if you jump into Logan's Run and they look at how it's adapted from the book to the screen, it's showing more of the time period, because the end of the book is completely different from the end of the movie. In the end of the movie, they come up to land, they've been underwater, and the world has been destroyed, and nature has taken back over, and they're like all these nature's children, and, you know, you get the idea of the hippies coming out, and it's all going to be better now because the world has had time to heal itself. And in the book, that hasn't happened at all. They're not living underwater. They're living above ground in these cities, and everything's still destroyed. In order to survive at all, the only chance you have is in outer space.
Right. Which you lose a lot of that in the movie. Because
right,
it's more of a straightforward action film.
Right. And they, you know, they cut a lot of the different scenes, and they make them older. I think in the movie they live to be 30, and in the book it's 21.
Yeah, it is. In the movie, it's 30.
Of life.
Yeah. I will say that I enjoyed Logan's Run as a movie, because at the time I saw it, I didn't realize it was a book, and I picked it up at a bookstore at one point and kind of blew through it when I was toward the end of my college career and realized how different it was. But see, the way I do it, if I watch the movie first and then read the book, I can generally enjoy both of them. Like, that's the way I did with Jurassic Park. I think if I'd have read Jurassic Park first and then saw it, I would have been disappointed with the movie. But I saw the movie first and went and read the book, and it kind of enhanced my viewing experience.
See, and I think I'm the other way around. I like to read the book first and then go see a movie. That's a prerequisite I have with my son, that if he wants to see a movie that is a book, we're going to read the book before I let him see the movie. I'm not really sure why I'm like that, probably because I teach reading. But
well, I can see that.
But I will say that, you know, it's got to be hard for a screenwriter to adapt a book. I mean, I'm telling you, you got this work of fiction that someone has written that's semi-famous enough to be made into a movie. As a screenwriter, if you're not the author of the story, and I have found that a lot of times the author of the story is no good for writing screen adaptations. Stephen King is a good example of that. His adaptations he writes are terrible.
They are.
I would have to say, however, that Stephen King's dramatic literary stories end up translating into much better movies than his horror ones do. A good example, of course, is The Shawshank Redemption, which is Rita Hayworth.
Green Mile. Shawshank.
The Green Mile is a fantastic. It is almost word for word the books, and it translates very well.
The thing about The Green Mile that always amazes me is the key element that would have proven the what is the guy's name that. The big guy that
Coffee,
has the,
John Coffee.
The one detail that would have saved him is left out of the movie. They don't mention the fact that he can't tie his shoes. And in the book, the screen door is tied open with a shoestring. And in the book, he can't tie. He can't tie a bow. And that doesn't come out in the movie at all to prove. I mean, we know he's innocent because we get to see his vision in the movie. But in the book, it could have been proven in his court case. So not only was he innocent because of the vision that Tom Hanks' character is able to see by touching John Coffey, but in the book, it's made worse by the fact that the attorneys don't allow that in court. And so it's an interesting thing that they bothered to leave out of the movie to keep it more fantastic. Is
well,
that
you know,
fantasy?
You know, as much detail that they left in the movie, there's other stuff they could have cut out. Maybe it was just something that they filmed that didn't work. I mean, they haven't really put much of a special edition DVD. And that's the great thing about DVDs. You can go back and see some of the stuff they did cut out due to time constraints. And Harry Potter is a good example. They cut a lot of stuff out that looks good. But because little kids have short attention spans, you know, they don't want to put this super long movie out. But I found that it didn't matter because the kids were sitting there staring at Harry Potter the whole time.
Well, and also the plot and subplots become complicated for them
mm-hmm.
in movies is to understand. You have this overall plot, main plot from beginning to the end of the movie, and then you have the different subplots, which in the first Harry Potter book, there are fewer subplots, but obviously as he gets older, there become more and more subplots and conflicts, and then they stretch from book to book throughout the series, which of course was the design. But
right.
when you take that to screen, I think that's why the first two movies were not as well done, just in my humble opinion, as the third movie, because the first two were so close to the books and they stayed true to that form that it didn't adapt to the screen well. And I know you don't agree with me on that, but I think the third one was a better movie. I think the first two were truer to the book.
The third movie was beautifully shot. I think it's the most beautiful of all the films because the director, he's a Spanish director. Alfonso Cuarón is his name. And just the way he would frame up the scenes and do the lighting. And I love the way he redesigned the costumes for the kids and made them more like teenagers than he did these stodgy kids in robes. He made the robes look better. He made, you know, they're wearing teenager clothes when they're not at school. And it's just more realistic to what school would be like, I guess. And, you know, he did some things with the characters that they hadn't done in the first two movies. And they progressed with that as he went along. I thought that the Goblet of Fire was a good movie, but there was something about it. It's my least favorite of all of them. And Order of the Phoenix is great. They handled, like, you know, Dolores Umbridge. I don't want to get too much into Harry Potter because our show next week is total Harry Potter.
Right.
And the Half-Blood Prince.
The adaptation from book to screen is what we want to focus on. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. This is where you need your cricket sound.
Cricket, cricket, cricket. I'll have crickets next week, folks. We're getting more technologically advanced here on Cultum and Audio. My opinion on the Harry Potter books is instead of putting them on the big screen, and I understand why they do that, it's to get more audience in there, they should have made a miniseries out of it, each book.
I'm really surprised
they didn't go back.
Could
have had like a 4-hour miniseries or something.
You know, if this was the 1980s, they'd have a cartoon of Harry Potter, because it seems like in the 80s, when they'd have a successful movie, it turned into a miniseries and then, or a cartoon. I mean, I'm thinking Punky Brewster had her own cartoon. Everything seemed to go from screen.
Ghostbusters had a cartoon. They had two, actually.
I don't remember watching, but it just seemed that it progressed that way.
Well, now it's the trend is cartoons into movies, a la Transformers
exactly.
and G.I. Joe.
Right. There seems to be a lot of books coming into movies now, almost like the screenwriting isn't there anymore, so they're just going straight back to books. I just don't remember that from when I was younger.
I just
didn't pay attention to it. I just think it's more now.
It was there, just not as bad as it is now. I mean, now the point is if a book company has a book they think can be made into a movie, they'll shop out the movie rights as they're publishing the book. And so they have a contract with some, like, J.K. Rowling had a movie contract, I think, before the first book really came out. And the way I was reading it on her Wikipedia page, you know, I have to take Wikipedia with a grain of salt.
So they'll say Wikipedia.
Yeah. The story of how she got that book published is pretty interesting. You know, it was one of those guy took it home over the weekend kind of things. He sat down and read the whole thing. Then he tried forever to get the rest of the people to read it so they would publish it. And they're all like, fantasy stories, whatever. And then the next thing you know, somebody publishes it and becomes the biggest juggernaut in the history of books.
Right.
Except for next to it sold more copies than the Bible last year, which is a shocker.
I know Scholastic paid $1 million for it, for the U.S. rights when it came up at auction.
Right.
But I think that's true. I think they have a lot of books, and I think they're doing it too fast and not putting enough budget into making the movies. I mean, I've got to bring up Twilight because, you know, I've got to. But, you know, here's a phenomenal series. She already had all four books out at that time before they produced Twilight. And when you look at Twilight, it's just like, what did they do? Decide not to fund it because the special effects are bad? They stayed close to the book on that one, and that might have been one that would have been better suited to have cut some things.
I was reading a
review of scenes that were looking at each other.
I was reading a review of Twilight earlier from fans of the book, like big, huge fans. There's like the Twilight website where they're talking about it. And the consensus is people thought the movie was all right. Except for the little gusher ladies that are like, oh, I love Edward, ooh, you know, and that they just talk about how fantastical the movie is. Fantastical. I probably just made that up. But most
it
of them are
okay,
like,
except
the
for
problem,
his running and climbing. That was just hokey.
The problem most people seem to have with the books were the secondary characters got no description at all. It was just kind of they were there, and they were in scenes they shouldn't have been that were in the book. And like some of the major characters, there was like apparently one major character is not even in the movie, and they took two characters and combined them into one character, according to this website. They were all talking about it. And
but
that,
you kind of have to do that coming into a movie so that you don't have so many characters and making it complicated. But, yeah, and I think New Moon was worse because the characters just have tiny bit parts. They're called, I would call them a cameo appearance.
Right.
Whereas in the book, it's much more developed. But
basically, they just made the story of the two main leads in the movie and had the other people there because you got to have other people in the movie.
But,
excuse me.
You can edit that out.
Yes, I'm going to. Hold on. I have a drink here. I can not choke to death. And I will edit that out, too. And I keep saying that, but it'll probably show up because I'm lazy and don't want to edit. So.
But where's the Cheetos bag to rattle?
I don't have Cheetos with me today. I'm trying to stay off the Cheetos a little bit.
Oh,
yeah, you're having a heart attack there. You've only seen me with one bag of Cheetos, okay? I just talk about them all the time. Two bags of Cheetos. Hey, tomorrow's my birthday, so I'll eat some Cheetos for myself. Anyway, getting back to Twilight, I can see where like that fan base has a rabid following. I mean, it's like more than Potter rabid. But I see what they did. Those books didn't really get too popular until I think about the time Deathly Hallows came out, and people didn't have anything else to read, and these books were already out. They were already out at the time. They were getting a cult following, but they weren't like a hugely
right.
crazy success story like they are now. The movie really helped that because.
Right.
I know
I'm trying to think how long ago I bought, because I bought Twilight and New Moon for my classroom the last year I taught 8th grade language arts. So I'm trying to count back 1, 2, 3, 4 years ago that I bought those for my classroom. And they were fairly unheard of. I know myself and the other language arts teachers had read them, and we thought, oh, this is really good, prior to the release of Eclipse. But they did not become widespread among my students. And, you know, granted, I'm in middle school until Eclipse came out, and then they started being pulled off the shelf. And then once the Twilight movie was out and Breaking Dawn was out, I ended up having to buy a total of 3 copies of each of the first 3 books. I can't put Breaking Dawn on my shelves in middle school.
Wow.
Because they're phenomenal. So that's one of the things I do like when they make a book into a movie is a lot of the kids will then go grab the book to see what the comparison is if they where they might not have ahead of time, especially since the books are lengthy. Harry Potter's the same way. A lot of kids bother to read it because they don't have to worry about not understanding it. They've already seen the movie, so they can at least follow the main plot line.
Right. And, you know, I'll eventually get to watching it here pretty soon. We have it here at the house, so I'll probably go to sleep to it one
day. Read it first. Read it.
I will read it, but I'm trying to read Percy Jackson right now so I can go see the movie.
Oh, Percy Jackson.
Yeah, we're going to segue into that. All right, so what's your first impression without giving spoilers for people who haven't seen it?
Well, you can't not spoil it. Maybe you should say spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen Percy Jackson. And I guess I'm screwed because I have to listen to what she's saying. No, it's no big. I don't care if I get – I don't care about spoilers. I'm the one that goes and looks up spoilers for the next season of the show.
Well, I mean, I can't spoil it for you because the ending, with the exception of the secret bad guy, the surprise twist ending bad guy
–
isn't the ending that's in the book. So that's another one that they adapted for screen to make it much more dramatic for the big screen. It would not have been as dramatic. The way it ends in the book is very subtle, very sneaky, very underhanded from the movie, because in the movie it's very flashy, and you know Percy calls on his water power. I mean, hopefully it's not a spoiler alert that he's the son of Neptune.
I don't think so. They pretty much tell you that in the previews.
In the movie they do, and it takes him a while in the book to find that out. But they do a good job with the exposition, whereas in the book it has great exposition. It's not so much that the kids are bored, but in the movie they work the exposition, all that background information, into the conversations he has with other characters. He's hearing his father's voice in his head, that kind of thing. But it's set, the thing I found the strangest for this adaptation, in the book, he's 11. And it goes through the series of him growing up until the last book where he's 16. And it's very important. His 16th birthday is going to be very, very important because something's going to happen. I'm not going to spoiler that one because that's the whole book series. But in the movie, he's already 16 because he's driving a car. So I'm not sure how they're going to adapt that if they plan on turning the other books into a movie. I'm not sure how, if Riordan was part of the screenwriting from the book because he's, you know, Percy's much older. He's in high school. And the movie is kind of aimed at probably a 14-year-old rather than a 10 or 11-year-old. There was a ubiquitous drug scene where they're eating the lotus flowers and I know.
I had heard that was a big problem that people were having with that, and there was a lot of sexual innuendo in the movie too.
Yes, like, there were. Persephone is made out to be just. I don't have
a big hoe.
Yeah, there you go. She, you know, comes on to one of the main characters, and it just doesn't fit. She says, "You know, I've never had a satyr." And
nice.
I thought, please don't let my kids ask me what it means to have one. And my son did. He goes, does she eat them? And I just laughed. I said, let's just watch the movie.
It's like, yes, maybe. If you cook them right, they probably taste good. Mm.
Yeah. No, goat's not.
That reminds me of a funny story. My mother took me at the ripe age of like 7 or 8 to see Risky Business, not realizing what it was about.
Oh, no.
She, you know, about 5 minutes in the movie, she's like, you need to go over to you need to go over to Mr. Mom real quick. No, Mom, this is cool.
Right. Yeah, that was, there was a, like I said, it was aimed at probably 14, 13 to 15 because of the drug scene. And it was just really odd because my son's like, I don't remember that in the book. Was that in the book? I was like, well, they ate the flowers and they, you know, they forgot what time it was. So that's something that, as I said, would be funny to a 14-year-old, but not for the young children. And most of the kids in the audience today, when I went to see it, were probably 6 to 12. There were a few teenagers.
So the target audience for the teenagers isn't really going to see this film. It's more the younger kids because they're the ones reading it right now.
The book is written, he's 11, so you've got to figure as an author, if you're writing and your character is 11, you're aiming for 2 years under to 2 years above.
Right.
That movie itself was aimed at probably 14-year-olds, so you're looking at 12, pushing it at 16. So that was, I mean, that
was a it was a big problem with the people that figured that one out. They're like, let's do 14-year-olds, but your target audience is a lot younger, so parents are going to be really upset, I guess, when they see some of that stuff. Now,
they change locations in the movie for some reason. That's something I don't understand when they do that with a movie that. Yeah, they didn't go to the St. Louis Arch. They ended up in Nashville. And so they changed some of the plot elements. Maybe it was easier to film.
Now, I heard that Hades was the coolest part of the movie, though.
They had great special effects. I'm going to tell you, and you and I have had this conversation off air about, I don't think Harry Potter has really good special effects. And this one did. They had really good special effects. The water effects were good. Hades was really good.
I meant the character himself. I heard that Hades himself was pretty cool. He's one of the best parts of the movie.
Well, that's special effect. When you see it, you'll understand.
Okay. Another thing is that people are complaining about is there's a couple of scenes that are very emotional in the book that are just played off as nothing in
They're
the movie.
Missing.
And for someone who like has lost a family member, he didn't seem to care a whole lot. It's like,
well, it's explained to him very quickly in the movie. Like his first night there, he's told, you can get your mom back.
Okay.
And in the book, he doesn't know that for a long time, so it's a lot more emotional. And that's something that you have to adapt for the screen, that you can't, they don't have time in the movie to drag it out. He's not at Camp Half-Blood very long in the movie. He's there one day. And so you don't have the mystique of who's his real dad. You don't see him develop the relationship with Luke, the counselor. You get none of the subplot of Luke and Grover and Annabeth. That's just not there. You don't have that subplot at all.
They were talking about, like, there's a major character in the book also that's not in the movie.
Clarice is not in the movie at all. In fact, Annabeth kind of takes Clarice's place in the movie, which is very odd when you read the book.
Wow. So it was almost like, let's go to this kitty scissor class to write this book, make it into a movie.
And I think that the problem for the movie, Clarice is not that major of a character for the Lightning Thief. But when you hit Sea of Monsters, I'm not sure how they're going to compensate for that. And the same thing goes with Harry Potter, with Dobby's character. You know, that they've got him in the second book, Chamber of Secrets, but they don't show him again
so far.
Yeah, they haven't shown him again, and I'm not sure what they're going to do with that when they get to the seventh book.
I will say this. I have all my faith in Steve Kloves, the guy who's been writing the script. So far, the stuff he has cut out, it's worked. And I think he'll make it work somehow. They'll explain away Dobby's appearance. They'll be able to do it. And he's just too integral to the plot of Deathly Hallows to not have in it. Because he kind of sets forth some of the stuff that... Something that happens to him sets forth what really drives Harry to just go all out with everything. And I'm looking forward to that one. Even if it is split up into two movies, you have to wait 6 months in between to see the end of. It's going to be great.
I'm hoping, as a teacher, I'm hoping that when the first one comes out, that kids who haven't read the seventh book will not be satisfied with waiting 18 months for the next movie to come out.
They'll want to know what happens.
They're going to want to know what happens. So as a teacher, I'm hoping that pushes them to go get the book and read it.
Well, it's sitting on my shelf, and I've probably read it 3 times since it came out. So.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I've read it, I don't know how many times. Of course, we have the audio CDs, so we've listened to it more than that.
Oh, yes. I have a little file on my computer where I've acquired the soundtracks and all the audiobooks. Anyway, when we're waiting for new episodes of Doctor Who, we call it taking the red eye flight on the Concorde to England when you acquire an episode. So, oops, I just let that one out of the bag. BBC's going to knock on my door now. So, going back to some movie book film adaptations, we'll throw some names out there real quick. And there's a lot of things on this list I found of books to film that I didn't realize were books to film. Like there's a movie with Mel Gibson and Robert Downey Jr. called Air America. It's a book. And that movie was originally supposed to have Robin Williams in it, and he turned it down.
It would have been too much like
Good Morning Vietnam, yeah. And it's a good movie. I didn't read the book, so I don't know anything about it. I can't really. Now, I did read the book that Adrian Cronauer wrote about his experiences in Vietnam, and do know that while Good Morning Vietnam is a great movie, he ain't nothing like they portray him in the movie.
No.
But that's just Robin Williams, and he's just fun to watch, and the real guy would have been as boring as the other guys that were talking on the thing. So, I think that sometimes you got to take some dramatic license, and it's mostly in the performances. But I have found that the best adaptations are plays that get turned into movies. Because, you know,
I saw a terrible one with Will Smith, and it was supposed to be – it's been highly praised. I can't even think of it.
Six Degrees of Separation.
Yes, I didn't care for that at all.
It's just one of those plays that – one of those real avant-garde esoteric plays that you really got to get into. But I mean, I thought it was good. One of my favorite adaptations of a play ever is 12 Angry Men. Both versions of it are good because they remade it in the 90s.
With Henry Fonda.
Yeah, Henry Fonda was in the original along with Jack Lemmon. No, Jack Lemmon's not in that, is he? Oh, God, I've confused myself. Henry Fonda's in it, and he's great. Jack Lemmon's in the remake. That's what it is. He's the Henry Fonda character in the remake. And they're both good, but they use the same script because it's a play. And a lot of times you can tell when it's a play because they act like they're in a play instead of like they're in a movie. And I'm not counting Broadway musicals. They're different. But the original Dracula...
Go ahead. Jump in on the Broadway because they changed Wicked, you know, Wicked the musical from the book. And that's just, I know we're not talking about books to movies, but to go from a book to a musical.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of
dramatic. And they did that with The Sound of Music because she wrote her story and then they converted it to a musical. The Von Trapp family singers.
Right.
And I've actually read the autobiography, or the biography, I guess it is, of that, and then they converted it into a musical, and that's an interesting adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, I like it. But I mean, and I'm sure she wasn't thinking that stuff in her head when she wrote the book as far as the songs. But that's the way back then they started popping everything out as a musical. Mary Poppins is a. If you want to see something funny, folks, go to YouTube and type in Scary Mary Poppins. Somebody has cut the trailer to Mary Poppins to make it look like a scary movie where she's like this psycho crazy lady in the house. Oh, it's funny. It's just funny when they do that. Let's see. Oh.
But that's a book. That's a book that they edited to pieces.
Yes.
Because the whole series, I mean, there's more children, and it's much more different. Because I can remember as a child realizing it was a real book, and then being shocked and even a little disappointed. That's one of the few I would say I like the movie better than the book is
right.
With Mary Poppins.
Well, I mean, Disney has a flair for taking stuff and adapting it, and sometimes it's not close to the book, but it's always enjoyable, I think, because Disney takes the care to make it, you know, they want to make the buck, so they're going to make it as good as possible so people will go watch it. One remake of a children's book that I think is freaking fantastic and almost on the nose is Matilda.
Yes.
That was one of my favorite. Yeah. Now, Roald Dahl books have got to be hard to translate.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is another exceptional, both of them, the original and the new one with Johnny Depp.
That one's creepy. Johnny Depp is...
But it's really close to the book.
Yeah, it is. And I wish somebody would finally do Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator so we can see what a vernicious canid looks like, because I really want to see that. It was one of my favorite books when I was in grammar school. You ever read that one? Charlie and
yes,
the Great Glass Elevator? That's a great... But the thing is, there again, it's. I think he wrote that book in the late 60s, early 70s, maybe? Or did he write that back in the 20s and 30s?
That I don't know.
I have to look that up, because somebody was telling me about it, that there's a lot of time travel space station in a square little box thing flying around in space. Kind of, it's very familiar to something else that some of us know about. all right, I'll throw...
That? Oh, Doctor Who?
Yeah. I'll throw out what I think is one of the worst adaptations of a book, and it's a somewhat relative of mine, which is L. Ron Hubbard's Battlefield Earth. Absolutely worst movie of all time. It's like on every top 10 list of worst movies ever made. And you
bad
will,
movies?
Oh, God, it's awful. But it's a bad adaptation because Battlefield Earth has like almost 3,000 pages, and they only did the first quarter in this 2.5-hour movie.
Do you think that they thought it was going to be okay and that they'd be able to come back and make sequels?
They probably thought that because it had John Travolta and Barry Pepper in it,
right.
You know, and God, what's his name? Anyway, it doesn't matter. The movie's crap. It's, as my British friends would say, shite. it was produced by the Church of Scientology, and I guess they thought it was going to be this big major
and
thing.
And we wonder why. L. Ron Hubbard? Right?
Hey, now. I think he wrote a book called Dianetics, which is a self-help book, and his kid took it and made a religion out of it, which is, hey, who wouldn't if they could make a religion? It's a famous story where George Lucas said to Steven Spielberg one day, you know, we could turn Star Wars into a religion. And he just said, yeah, we could, but why would we? You know, and there's some church in Australia that's the Church of the Jedi or something stupid like that. That's taking your fandom just a little bit too far, folks.
Yeah, that's a little... Okay, the publication date on Charlie and the Chocolate Factory is 1964.
Okay, what about the Great Glass Elevator?
Great Glass Elevator, 1972.
Ha, he ripped off Doctor Who. I'm just kidding.
And he planned to write a third book, but never finished it.
My favorite book by him is The Fantastic Mr. Fox, which I can't wait to see the adaptation of because it's a total claymation film, but it's supposed to be very, very good. It came out this past Christmas time.
As opposed to claymation, it all sucks. I don't like claymation.
Oh, come on. You got to like Rudolph and stuff like that.
No, I really I hated it as a kid. It bugged me.
Why, because of the jerky way they moved?
Yeah, I thought...
Or the fact that Rudolph's a big, just whiny butt.
No, the way they move. I can handle the whiny butt part.
Did you like Frosty? It was a straight cartoon. Frosty the Snowman, come on.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
when he melts at the end. Should have been our list of stuff that made us cry. He does too, and then they take him out and he gets refrozen and comes back to life.
With a hat.
Yeah.
But anyway, talking about books.
Yeah. Sorry.
I think an interesting thing that they have done is now they're taking short stories, Where the Wild Things Are and Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs, and stretching those into full-blown movies. I didn't get to go see Claudia with a Chance of Meatballs.
I actually saw that the other day, and it was pretty good. I need to go back and read the source.
Is it still in theaters? Because it's not out.
No, it's on DVD.
Yeah. Oh, it's being recorded.
She's got a little hot little British accent there. Anyway.
Every time I try to do a hot little British accent, I sound like some gutter snipe from inner city London. It just doesn't come
right. You use the Cockney.
Yeah. That's what happens when you're from, you know, South Georgia. And then
South Georgia, and if I do a British accent, it don't sound right.
Don't sound too right.
I try to do Irish, it sounds Scottish, and then it sounds like bad Scottish. Well, we can talk, all right, book to film adaptations. A big genre is John Grisham. Just about most of the first third of his books have been made into movies now, and some of them are really good.
Most of them very good.
Right. I would have to say that, to me, still his best book that I've read is A Time to Kill, which was his first book. I love that book, and it's written very well. Not to say the other ones aren't good, but some of them are terrible. I've read just about everything John Grisham's put out.
Really?
And
that's saying.
I didn't really enjoy The Street Lawyer that much, and I didn't enjoy The Brethren. I mean, some of his later books have just ended. You know, not good endings. He's just, I'm John Grisham. I could write a poem on a piece of paper and sell it, and it would make money.
It's like he got in a hurry on the endings. He wrapped them up too quickly.
I think he has ghostwriters, too.
Oh, really?
Well, all right. James Patterson's another example. He writes all these books about Alex Cross.
I don't like James Patterson.
I'm a fan of the Alex Cross stories, but you notice he's got James Patterson and so-and-so, and they've put this story out. Well, basically, this guy wrote it and got it published under James Patterson's name, and he'll, like, throw some stuff in there so that he can actually...
Fred C. Pascal's done the same thing. I mean, going back to, obviously, I teach middle school, so going to that set, but she's done the same thing from Sweet Valley High, and now there's all these books out, and she's got a new series called Fearless, and I'm thinking it's ghostwriters.
Oh, yeah. Well, at that point, you can hire somebody to write it for you and just be rich.
But going back to John Grisham's movies, I think a lot of them are really good. He's got some well-paid actors, good, high-quality. You know,
Julia Roberts.
Julia Roberts, thank you. And
that's about the
Tom
only movie
Cruise.
I enjoyed. Now, see, like, The Firm, I thought, was a great adaptation of a book. It was almost exactly, there were a few things that they changed about it, but, you know, it's stuff that didn't work at the time the book was written that's working now.
Right.
And it's, you know, he changed the ending of it, but see, Grisham wrote the script to that, so it's his story.
Okay.
He can change the thing if he wants to. The Client was good. The kids in that were really good. I'd have to say I don't really have a problem with any of the Grisham adaptations.
I'll tell you who has had rough adaptations or up or down, you know, not consistently good, is Crichton.
Oh, Michael Crichton? Yeah.
Yes, and like I love Timeline. I really know
that's my favorite Michael Crichton.
It is me too. I was going to say, you know, it's not one of his most popular, but I love Timeline. And I was thrilled when I found out they had a movie. I told everybody, we've got to see Timeline. I go with this big, huge crowd. And when it was over, I was embarrassed that I had suggested we see
this didn't
movie.
Think Timeline was that bad. And I think they had actually the right cast to play the characters. I just think the directing was terrible.
It was bad. I think the screen adaptation, they lost a lot.
They trimmed a lot out.
They took out a lot. Yeah.
And they changed some things around, but, I mean... Gerard Butler is really good.
My favorite parts.
What was your favorite part?
Just the relationship building in between the characters, and I just thought it was really cool how he was able to bury his glasses.
Oh, in the past.
They found it in the future, and that was, to me.
I do think in the movie he fell in love with the French girl a little bit too fast.
Yeah, I know,
so
I did.
The future
French
to do it.
Girl.
She spoke the French. I must be in love with her. But, I mean... I thought that the guy that played the villain was excellent. David Thewlis, who played the guy back at home, he was great. Billy Connolly as the archaeologist who gets sent back first and they're trying to find is great. Paul Walker's actually good in it, and he's usually crap in a movie. I mean, did you see the script?
I didn't have a problem with the acting. I think it was just, like you said, the directing, and then I didn't think it was a good script adaptation.
They truncated the story too much to fit it on there, and it was a Michael Crichton story, so they're trying to get it out there. You know, it's like we were talking about Jurassic Park and The Lost World earlier. Those are very good movies. I did not enjoy, book-wise, The Lost World book is way better than the movie because there's just so much cool stuff going on that they didn't put in there.
Right.
Jurassic Park, the movie, however, it's similar enough to enjoy it, but they changed some things to make it more family-friendly. And there are certain characters right. that you would have really hated had they left them the way they were. And, you know, they changed, the major thing they changed was the Alan Grant character did not want kids in the movie, and in the book he was wanting kids really bad right. and spent the whole time having fun teaching these kids as they're going through the bush. Right. I think that it would have been better if they'd have left it that way, because it's a kids' movie. But he's got some kind of redemption thing going on, and you find out later that he is, what was I going to say? I'm going to brain fart real quick. Oh, you find out later that he never had children, and
no, I think the thing in the movie is that if we're going to have to edit this, hold on.
Oh, it's okay. It's the beauty of
it. Brian, can I have a little help? I'm wrapping this up. I hope you edit.
I'm going to edit. Trust me, I'll edit that out.
Okay, I think the thing that they were doing in the movie, we talked about subplots briefly earlier, is the fact that they were trying to show how his character is not static. You know, his character changes from not liking kids to enjoying being with the kids.
Right. And the Ian Malcolm character was just nutty all the way. They made him nuttier by having Jeff Goldblum play him. But, you know, I think overall, good movie. And, like I said again, Goldblum's character was a nut, but he was the funniest thing to watch. Laura Dern was all right. And the cast they had for that was great. It was Spielberg. Spielberg at his best. And the thing is, about that particular year, speaking of adaptations, he went from Jurassic Park, he finished filming it, and flew to, I think, Czechoslovakia and filmed Schindler's List. And was editing Jurassic Park at night via satellite and filming Schindler's List during the day. So
I didn't realize Schindler's List came out that close to Jurassic Park.
Yeah, it came out like 6 months later in the theater, but he was filming it as he was editing it. George Lucas actually edited Jurassic Park for him and did some of the finishing touches and second unit filming. And
see, that's what I think. I wish Harry Potter had been done by Lucas and Spielberg.
You think? I think it would have been too much, personally. I think there would have been too much crap in there. It would have been too childlike wonder fantastical, because they would have been, oh, this is That's Harry Potter, awesome. We got to make it that way.
Make it that way.
You know, Chris Columbus put some subtlety in there, and then once he set up the world, you're used to it. So they don't cram the walking pictures every 5 seconds that somebody's walking by something. You just know it's there. And whenever they show it, you're not surprised, which is good, because it doesn't detract from the rest of the story. I would just say that Spielberg, it's like Spielberg directing a Star Wars movie just wouldn't work. He would make it too fantastical. Not that
yeah,
they
I think
were.
Lucas already took care of that himself, but that's a different discussion.
George Lucas raped my childhood with that prequel trilogy. That's all I'm saying. Jar Jar Binks can go yeah. stick it.
Talking about books to movie, usually as a reading teacher, I really like the book much, much better than the movie, but I've had a couple. Back with when Titanic came out, it was actually knocked out of first place very briefly by Man in the Iron Mask.
Oh yes,
Leonardo DiCaprio playing himself, and that is one. And I loved Three Musketeers. I love Alexandre Dumas, but Man in the Iron Mask was a much better movie. Had a much more satisfying ending than the book did. And I enjoyed it better than the book, which is saying something.
Well, Alexandre Dumas is very hard to read. First, they're translating it from French, so some of the meaning is lost in the translation. And it was
exceptional.
Okay, fine. I had trouble with The Man in the Iron Mask, but I should probably go back and read it.
Did you read Three Musketeers first?
Yes.
Because it's actually... See, I read Three Musketeers and was so hooked on it, I actually rationed out the last chapter and only let myself read 2 pages at a time because I didn't want it to be over.
Well, you know, my actual favorite Dumas book is The Count of Monte Cristo.
Oh, see, that one I actually liked.
The movie was great. Yeah, the movie.
I like the end. Let me rephrase that. I like the ending of the movie better than the ending of the book. Now, I loved the book's details and the plot of it and all the characters, but when it came to the ending, I was much happier with the ending of the movie than I was the ending of the book, which is what I think a lot of people forget when they make a movie and they follow the book too closely. Sometimes you do have to change the ending to make it more spectacular or make it more satisfying.
I think sometimes when you're producing a film like an adaptation, you get a lot of directors and writers that are just extremely huge, huge fans of. And they're fans to the point where they just overdo it. They're so ingrained in the story that they got to put every little thing in there. Then you got to get a director or producer that knows the material but isn't like gaga over it. So they can actually say, okay, I know you love that scene, but we got to cut it. It's like, all right, you're a writer. You're going to have to edit a book soon, right?
How do you edit out things? I wanted them to move. I'm thinking, okay, I want them to see how this character acted just like they did it. So instead of saying the character, you know, snatched the door open, you tend to, as a writer, get carried away with stomping to the door, heavy footsteps. And I'm sure in movies they do the same thing. They're just
but they do it quicker because you're watching it. You know, you don't have to read the description. I'm talking about key scenes in your book that you have to cut out because it's running too long. That you got to look at the stuff that it's good, but does it push the plot along? If it doesn't push the plot along, you got to lose it and push the plot. And that's the biggest problem with movies, because you see director's cuts of stuff and you're like, all right, here's a good point. I think the Fellowship of the Ring comes out in the theater. And it's a fantastic movie. It's pretty dead on to the book. That's the best of the three movies, I think, the first one.
I would agree.
Does a great job of setting them up. Then the special edition comes out where they add an hour, and I was like, how did they freaking cut that out of the movie and still make it good?
Right. And it was good. The first one was exceptional, and I thought the first book of the Tolkien.
Yeah, it's my favorite. It's like more of a straightforward adventure. And then as one of the characters in Clerks 2 says, it's just three movies with a bunch of people walking to a freaking volcano. And it really is.
It really is.
But it's, you know, I would have to, have you seen the extended version of any of those movies?
No.
Go back and watch Fellowship of the Ring and it will blow your mind. It's so good. It's three times better than the theatrical version. And you're like, how did he cut that stuff out? I mean, I can't fathom it. I mean, it's not just little stuff either. They got whole scenes of stuff that the only thing that they never filmed and didn't put in the movie was the Tom Bombadil part, and that's what everybody wanted to see. Wow. I mean, he's like the best part of the book, and they didn't even film it.
That's funny you should mention that.
Why?
I'll tell you later. I'll tell you off air.
Okay. It's saucy.
Anyway.
I guess our point is that sometimes your impression as a person who reads a lot and actually teaches the language, what makes a successful adaptation?
Of a movie.
Of a book to a movie.
I think that you stay true to the main character's characterization, that their qualities, their good qualities and their bad qualities, and that you stay true to the main plot, because if you've read that as a book, that's what you're looking to see in a movie. I think it's okay if you end up cutting some of the subplots, but not where a subplot is a direct impact on the main course of events going on with the book. And the hardest thing I have a problem with as a teacher is when they just flat out change the ending of a book into something theatrical. But like I said, with Percy Jackson today, I don't want to ruin the ending for you because I know you haven't seen it or read it, but the ending in the book is very subtle. And the ending in the movie is very dynamic and compelling and spectacular. And so you have to do that. But then as you know, you and I are literate adults and we can talk about it, that's interesting to say, well, why did they do this? Why did they change it? What worked? What didn't? And how is that the impact on the story? Because you do still have a great story as a movie and you still have a great story as a book and you didn't lose the main characters. You didn't lose their personality in it, and I don't like to see their personalities lost in a movie, which is probably why I don't like the Twilight movie, the Twilight, not New Moon. I like New Moon much better, but I think they lost some of the characters in Twilight, and I don't like to see that coming out of a book.
Right. I understand. It's like if you lose the motivation for the character, why even do the movie? I mean, there's been several that have come out, and I'm trying to rack my brain right now to think of it that are just they're imaginings and name only. They took the name of the story and it ditched everything else and made a whole different story. And sometimes that story is better than the original. They just needed to purchase the
the rights to it. And like I said, I'm sorry. A good adaptation to me, and I guess you can call this a book because it's published in like graphic novel format. You know, for those of you who don't know, graphic novels are books that are like, you know, 150 to 200 page comic books, and they're usually not in color. They're just kind of drawn, and it's a novel actually, but you're just seeing.
Right. Yeah, they've got Dracula and Frankenstein.
Right.
And Wuthering Heights.
There's been two movies that I've seen on graphic novels that I really love. One of them is From Hell. You ever seen that? Had Johnny Depp in it.
Yes, I thought that was an exceptional movie.
Read
That's
the
movie
graphic novel. It's amazing. Yeah, it's good, and it gets into Masonic lore and Jack the Ripper and stuff like that. But it was beautifully shot by the Hughes brothers, who are known for Menace to Society, which shocked me because they did all these gangsta rapper movies, and suddenly they're doing this beautiful period piece. And the other graphic novel, which I do believe is also by Alan Moore, is The Road to Perdition. Which they that Tom Hanks movie. Yeah, that's another graphic novel, and it is phenomenal. That one will make you cry at the end. Should have gone on our show last week. Stuff that didn't work for me, like Watchmen, biggest 3-hour crap fest I've ever seen in my life. I never read the graphic novel.
I wouldn't even go see that one.
Some of the Batman adaptations have gotten good here lately. We won't get into that. That's comic book. That's fluff. But you know, stuff like Road to Perdition and From Hell are comic books, but they're considered books because they're over a certain length. And just because you have to watch the book as you're reading it instead of picturing it.
Okay, if it's gonna hook a kid to read, I'm all for it. I always tell them I don't care what you read as long as your parents are okay with it.
But I, as a guy, I'm saving the best adaptation for last. Okay. Still to this day, the greatest adaptation of a book to a movie has got to be The Godfather.
Very good, yes.
The Godfather was a fantastic film. It's based on a fantastic book. And
who's the author? Tell me the author.
Mario Puzo.
Puzo. I was going to say it. I just wanted to say it incorrectly.
But the thing about Puzo is he was there to help write the script when they were adapting everything, and that helped a lot. But they changed some things about it, but it was pretty much straightforward. And the cast that they cobbled together for that movie is about as perfect as you can get.
That's true. You saying Godfather reminded me of The Hunt for Red October. Also very well done.
That's a pretty straightforward adaptation. Not so great on some of the other Jack Ryan stories, I might say, though. Although, I did enjoy The Sum of All Fears, even though they had Ben Affleck playing him as a younger character. It wasn't terribly bad. The Bourne Identity. Totally different than the story, because you know what they left out of the Bourne books that are not in the movie? Who's his main protagonist? Who does Jason Bourne fight against a lot through those books? The Jackal. The Jackal, which they made into a movie with Bruce Willis. Those books were very good, and the movies are good, too. I mean, they're really good.
That's when I like the book better, because they deviate so much. The movie and the books are completely different to me. They're different ideas. You see a different thing in the movie than you read about in the book.
Right. And it was kind of interesting because they went on their own little tangent with the sequels. I mean, I think the third one's actually The Bourne Ultimatum's in name only, and that's about it. That's another one of those. But, I mean, there was a time when a lot of books were being adapted like that, and now they're starting to come to mind a little bit. The Girl with the Pearl Earring, it's a good movie. I never read the book.
That was a good movie. I didn't like the book the first time I read it. I liked the movie, and then I followed that up with another book by the same author, and it was okay, but the movie was better on The Girl with the Pearl Earring. It's just the style of writing I think I didn't care for in the original.
I started reading Girl Interrupted, but got interrupted reading it and never went back to it. The movie was great.
Yeah.
And the book was starting to get good.
I liked the book. I had to read the book after I saw the movie. The movie was incredible.
A good book that got turned into a movie is the book that Gettysburg is based on. And now I'm having a brain fart. Can't remember the name.
Was it Gods and Generals?
Gods and Generals was actually the sequel/prequel book. It was written after the Gettysburg book, but Killer Angels is the name of the Gettysburg book.
I always want to say Gods and Angels.
Yeah, Gods and
Gods and Generals was written after, but it's about the period leading up to Gettysburg. And then The Last Full Measure is the last one, and they haven't gotten the funding to do the movie yet. Gettysburg is fantastic and well acted and got a great cast.
What about North and South by, isn't that John Jacobs?
Oh, it's my favorite miniseries on Earth.
That's another one, like you said, going all the way back to turning a book into a miniseries so it can be well done.
And it was well done. Did you ever watch it? Did you sit in front of the TV? I've seen it so many times.
Can you imagine? I actually sat in front of the TV and watched that one.
It was all Patrick Swayze, though. Oh, poor Patrick Swayze. He's great in that, though, and the acting they had in that. But that is an example of a great miniseries that they changed the ending to the second book because the character was too popular, but it worked. And then when they went to do the third one and he didn't want to do it, they killed him off in the first scene, which they could have just done it the old way and it would have been fine.
Right.
But have you read the books?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just making sure. When the scene where Ori bites it, I cried, man, because you weren't expecting it. He goes to help this guy, and he blows his head off, and suddenly he's dead right there 3/4 of the way through the book, and you're like, damn it.
You never expect main characters to get killed off that quickly.
And, you know, that's a very bold choice as a writer to kill off, because, you know, everybody was thinking Harry Potter was going to die, surely, and I knew he wasn't, because she wants more money down the road, I'm sure, and sequels.
I don't think so, no. I don't think she's going
to. She does. She does apparently have this huge compendium coming out with everything.
Right, but that's not a sequel. I wish she'd prequel it, but she said she wasn't going to do that, though I heard she had written a short story for, or maybe they had auctioned it off or something, but about it was a scene between James and Sirius as students at Hogwarts.
Did you read the Tales of Beedle the Bard?
What do you think?
Yes, you did, of course. Probably haven't memorized. Here's
Rabbit. And the Hopping Stone.
Yeah, Babbity Rabbit. One of my favorite adaptations, I can't believe I didn't even think about this, was The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You've probably got the look in your face like, what is that? Douglas Adams.
Not only have I read it, I have choked through the movie. I have students that pick that book up, and I let them. I'm like, I'm fine. But, you know, if you get 20, 32 pages into it and want to get rid of it, let's find you another book.
My goodness. Someone who likes the English language like you doesn't like The Hitchhiker's Guide. How could you not like lines like the big yellow spaceships hung in space exactly the way a brick doesn't? I mean, come on. That's just funny. Or, you know, he makes the guy drink the beer so that when they get the transmat, it doesn't mess him up really bad. And he goes, you know, why am I drinking the beer? Because, you know, you're going to go through this transmat. And he goes, well, why is it such a big deal? He goes, you ever been drunk? He goes, what's wrong with being drunk? And he goes, ask a glass of water. And it's just the way he uses the language. It's fun. All right, I've waxed too much on that. The look on your face is like,
that's okay. I just really remember choking through the book. I wanted to read it because a guy I liked it. And so I wanted to read the book. And I mean, I just choked.
Well, you know what? I will tell you, the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide is a very long one, which I'm going to tell very quickly. The book came out of the radio show. It was a radio show in Britain, and it got so popular they made him write it as a book. So the novel doesn't, to me, work as well as the live show does.
Right.
And then they did a British TV show. It was like a 6-episode show, and that's a classic. It's great. But the movie was terrible. It was absolutely, the best part was Alan Rickman playing the robot. That was it.
The best part were the credits at the end.
No. It wasn't. Sam Rockwell was good in it. It was a goofy adaptation.
That's like saying, you know, the trees were good in it.
The trees were good in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
That's because they were alive.
I do have to say the character, the president, was good.
Zaphod Beeblebrox.
But anyway.
They made that movie more for the fans, though. And if you'd seen all the books and read all the movies and... Wait. If you read all the books and saw all the movies.
That's okay.
You know, a bad adaptation of a classic is I Am Legend. I didn't like the Will Smith movie. The book is fantastic. I just didn't.
I love the Will Smith movie. I liked it back when it was Omega Man with
Charlton Heston.
Charlton Heston. I liked both of those. Both very allegorical to, you know, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, it is. For some reason, didn't like Will Smith playing the part. It wasn't anything against Will Smith. I love Will Smith, but it just didn't. It's like iRobot was terrible, and that's Isaac Asimov. How do you screw up Asimov?
I don't know. I didn't think he did. I think you're screwed up, Wes.
Do you like iRobot?
I did like iRobot.
Some stuff that we disagree on makes the show more lively.
There you are. That's what we'll have to do a show on, is stuff that we don't agree on.
You probably like that stupid movie with Jude Law and Haley Joel Osment that Spielberg did, that AI. You probably liked that one too, didn't you?
I did not like AI. It was like 2 hours too long.
It was.
It just kept going.
Awful. You know what? It's the same story as Bicentennial Man with Robin Williams, and that was much better.
But it wasn't great.
It was pretty good.
It wasn't
great.
It's not great.
Okay, how about In the Heat of the Night?
So-so.
I never watched it. I'm really can't. In the Name of the Father, have you seen that with Daniel Day-Lewis? And we'll wrap up.
No, but I did see them do a really good, changed a whole bunch of Last of the Mohican plot, but that was all right.
That was pretty good, but it was nothing like the book.
No, I was, when I taught high school and we would read, in quotation marks, Last of the Mohicans, I would always make sure to ask questions, you know, because they changed the two main characters. The girls, they swapped them for each other. You can always tell the students that went, I'm just going to rent the movie from Blockbuster and, you know, pretend to read the book.
And then when they write the story, you're like, you didn't want to read the book at all because these characters are not right.
Right.
All right, we're going to get to the end. We could have talked about stuff like Jaws, which was good, or Interview the Vampire, which is good. I just want to throw those out there, but we're not.
Interview with the Vampire, because I really love the first book and think they just crucified the sequels.
Oh, and then the Queen of the Damned was a horrible, horrible, horrible movie, which I won't mention again.
You and I saw Interview with the Vampire.
We did, because that's when we were at school together in Georgia. A bunch of us went to see it, and I loved it, because we saw it in Atlanta, I think, and it was in digital surround sound, and dogs were barking behind us and stuff, and it was like, wow. We went with Rory, yep. I'm sure. All right, well, that's our show for today, and I hope you're going to be entertained once I edit this all together, throw some music on it.
I will be highly entertained, so.
Well, you were in it. You're entertaining, what can I say?
That was fun.
Hey, at least we didn't do a Valentine's Day show. That would have been kind of, you know, let's do love stories. Valentine's.
We could have.
Everybody should go read my post on Facebook under West Hubbard, because it's about how I feel about Valentine's Day. I'm a romantic softie, but Valentine's Day was invented by the card companies to make more money. Okay?
What about St. Valentine?
St. Valentine. I don't even know if he ran around with a bow and arrow and shooting people, making them fall in love.
That's Eros. That's the son of Aphrodite. That's a different show. We'll have to do myths.
Okay, myths and legends. All right. Well, from us here at the CIA home base, we will see you next week. Hopefully, same bat time, same bat channel.
And, thanks for having me again. I enjoyed it.
Thank Audrey for being here. Mike should be back next week. He is on assignment right now with his family, so we'll keep him in our thoughts and see you guys next week, where our topic will be keep your hand off my wand. No, wait, don't point your wand at me, I think it's what it says, and we're talking about Harry Potter.
I can't wait.
The show we did have this week is being postponed 3 weeks from now, where we're going to talk about Joss Whedon, and the week after that is cartoons of our childhood, so... lots to do. We will see you guys next week. Bye.